Welcome to Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee, a podcast brought to you by the Tennessee Initiative for Perinatal Quality Care. TIPQC exists to improve health outcomes for mothers and infants in Tennessee through our quality collaborative that will identify opportunities to optimize maternal and infant outcomes across our state and is funded under a grant contract with the state of Tennessee. The Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee podcast is designed for medical professionals and for patients and families across the state. We will focus on all aspects of the perinatal period with special attention to reducing our maternal mortality rate. This podcast is brought to you through a cooperative agreement with the Alliance for Innovation on Maternal Health.
Welcome to the Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee podcast brought to you by the Tennessee Initiative for Perinatal Quality Care. I am Danielle Tate, the TIPQC Past Maternal Medical Director. We're excited to have Dr. Michael Warren, the Chief Medical and Health Officer for the March of Dimes, joining us today. Previously, Dr. Warren served as Associate Administrator of the Health Resources and Services Administration, Maternal and Child Health Bureau. Under his leadership, MCHB's budget grew by 31% to $1.7 billion, with four new legislative authorities and multiple programmatic initiatives, including a pediatric pandemic network, a national maternal mental health hotline, and a doubling of the evidence-based home visiting program with new state matching grants. MCHB's programs reached 99% of infants, 93% of pregnant women, and 62% of children nationwide. Wow. Before joining HRSA, Dr. Warren served as Tennessee's Deputy Commissioner for Population Health. A board-certified pediatrician, Dr. Warren completed his residency, chief residency, academic general pediatrics fellowship, and master's in public health at Vanderbilt, where he also served as the clinical faculty. In addition to his March of Dimes role, Dr. Warren serves as adjunct professor of health policy and management at Emory University's Rollins School of Public Health. We are so honored to have you join us today, Dr. Warren, and also for your willingness to share. Welcome.
Thanks so much. It is great to be connected with TIPQC again. I really appreciate you having me.
Yes, well, we're going to dive right on in and pick your brain for the next few minutes, if you don't mind. First, just tell us about your career journey thus far, where you started out here in Tennessee, and actually what helped you to initiate the work with TIPQC as well.
Sure. Well, I actually came to Tennessee in 2003. Doesn't feel like that long ago, but over 20 years ago, I came to do my residency at Vanderbilt. And I came to Vanderbilt with the full intention of going back home to rural Eastern North Carolina to practice primary care pediatrics. My pediatrician was getting ready to retire, the pediatrician I had gone to growing up. And we had sort of worked out a deal that I would go to residency and then come back and he would retire and I would take over that practice. And it turns out while I was at Vanderbilt, I got bit by the policy bug. I became involved with the Tennessee chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics and attended the federal legislative conference. TNAP actually gave me a scholarship to go as a second year resident. And so I went along with another resident and a couple of senior pediatricians from Tennessee. And the following year, I actually did an internship in the AAP's Washington office. And so I go from being in the PICU 1 month to the next month being on Capitol Hill and going to legislative briefings and committee meetings and getting to interact with policymakers. And I realized throughout all of those experiences that many of the things that frustrated me in clinical care, particularly primary care, were not things that I had the tools to solve in a 15 or 20 minute clinic visit, and that there were opportunities to think about this bigger picture of health policy. But I was young and still loved primary care and had not found anybody who was going to pay me to do primary care most of the time, but to carve out a little bit of time to do sort of policy and advocacy work as a hobby. And so fortunately, I was asked to do a chief year at Vanderbilt there at the Children's Hospital. Loved the chief resident year, got to do a lot of teaching. Really, I was surprised that I enjoyed the administrative aspect of the work as well. But I got to the end of that year and had not come any closer to having a concrete career path. And so fortunately, one of my mentors said, you should think about a fellowship in academic general pediatrics. And so I stayed at Vanderbilt to do that. And as part of that fellowship, got a master's in public health. And that was the real door for me that led me into this work. So as part of the MPH curriculum, you had to do a practicum, 240 hours in some sort of public health setting. And I followed one of my pediatric mentors, Dr. Veronica Gunn, who was at Vanderbilt, to an entity called the Governor's Office of Children's Care Coordination in Tennessee. And that's particularly relevant in the history of TIPQC because when the Governor's Office of Children's Care Coordination, or GOCCC, was founded, they had a few focus areas, and one of those was around infant mortality and women's health. And Governor Bredesen at the time had set aside some money to address those issues. And one of the ways that the state was addressing the challenges around perinatal outcomes was by establishing a perinatal quality collaborative. This was long before the day of federal funding for PQCs, and there were only a handful of them in the United States, in fact. And so really grateful for visionary leaders like Judy Ashner and Peter Grubb and Brenda Barker, who said, we can figure out how to do this in Tennessee. And so they stood up TIPQC, and I came to learn about TIPQC when I was doing this practicum in the governor's office. And it really was exciting to see that work. I did that practicum for the 240 hours and then was fortunate to be able to stay on for a couple of years in the governor's office while I was doing clinical work at Vanderbilt, but also working in the governor's office for increasing amounts of time, actually. And at the end of a couple of years, Governor Bredesen was leaving office. That office was actually going to go away. And I had the opportunity to join the Tennessee Department of Health. And so I left Vanderbilt in 2010 and became the state maternal and child health director for Tennessee. I'd go on to spend the next 8 years at TDH and loved every minute of that, working on a variety of public health programs, ranging from child fatality review and family planning and home visiting. And when I was wrapping up my career at TDH, was responsible for a broad set of programs related to population health, including not only maternal and child health, but also chronic disease and vital statistics and population health data. And I loved every minute of that. I absolutely loved my time in Tennessee. But in 2018, I had the opportunity to make a transition to federal service. And so I joined the federal government. I went to work for an agency called HRSA, the Health Resources and Services Administration. Many people have not heard of HRSA, but they know of the work of HRSA. They've heard, for example, about federally qualified health centers, which are funded by HRSA, or the National Health Service Corps, or loan repayment programs that are funded by HRSA. But what they may not know is there's also a Maternal and Child Health Bureau. And so I went to lead that bureau and had the opportunity to do that for 6.5 years and was really excited to be able to work at the national level on programs that I had been implementing in Tennessee as actually a grantee of HRSA. And so it was interesting to be on the other side of that, particularly exciting to be able to work in the federal government at a time when there was a strong emphasis on maternal and infant health. And so to be able to routinely engage with the White House and with top leadership at HHS to be able to implement those priorities. And I did that until early 2025. And earlier this year, made the transition to March of Dimes. So a big switch from government, whether that's state or federal level, to move to the nonprofit space, but clearly still in the space of working to improve maternal and infant health. And so I'm just so grateful for those foundational experiences that I had in Tennessee, for all of the many folks that helped to teach me and shape me along the way. I feel like I carry all of those experiences with me every day.
Well, we are definitely grateful that you allowed those passions to develop here in Tennessee and you followed them here in Tennessee for the great trailblazing work that you're doing, not only at the state level, but of course, at the national level. We do appreciate it. Now, you've talked extensively, and I mentioned as well, your impressive stint nationally, first, as you mentioned, working with HRSA, and now with March of Dimes. Again, we thank you so much for focusing on moms and babies here in the state and nationally. But can you tell us more about the work you're doing with March of Dimes now?
Sure. March of Dimes has actually been around since 1938. We were founded as part of the nation's response to the polio crisis. And so we've moved from that crisis around a population health issue to another crisis, and that is the maternal and infant health crisis that we see today. And at March of Dimes, we really lead the fight for all moms and babies. We are focused on reducing preventable infant and maternal mortality. And I am so fortunate to be able to work with a team of folks across the country who are laser focused on making sure that every mom is healthy and every baby gets a healthy start. The portfolio of work that I'm fortunate to lead there is mixed. We've got some programmatic work. For example, we have mom and baby mobile health units that are deployed in locations across the country where access to care may be a challenge. We've got NICU family support programs in 70 units across the country. We know that for many families, that NICU journey is unexpected and can be very challenging to navigate. And so family support coordinators work with them and walk alongside them to help them navigate that NICU journey. And we've also got clinical quality improvement initiatives like our relatively new low-dose aspirin campaign focused on reducing the risks of developing preeclampsia and complications like preterm birth and other perinatal morbidity and mortality. So there's that bucket of programmatic work. There's also a bucket of research work. We know that while we've made tremendous advances over the course of our 87-year history, there's still so much we don't know. And in this space of maternal and infant health, one concrete example is the really large amount that we still don't know about prematurity. Prematurity is a leading cause of infant mortality in this country, and over 1 in 10 babies born premature in this country every year. And while we know some of the reasons why babies are born prematurely, we don't know the reason every time. And so there's a great opportunity, and we fund 6 prematurity research centers. We added the most recent center down in Texas earlier this year. It's actually a collaborative between the University of Texas at Galveston Medical Branch and UT Southwestern in Dallas. But we've got centers all across the country. And we also fund single investigator awards to be able to understand some of those causes of prematurity and also what interventions could work to reduce prematurity. We are also excited to have something called our Innovation Fund. Many people have heard of venture capital and how folks invest in startup companies. Well, we have something called venture philanthropy, where folks donate money to us, and we in turn invest in companies that are related to our mission. So we have, for example, invested in companies that are creating new models of providing mental health services for pregnant women and new moms across the country, particularly in areas where access is limited. And so really excited to think about where we might go with some of those investments. The last area of my portfolio is our advocacy portfolio. And I mentioned I sort of grew up getting my feet wet and my sort of start and interest in advocacy. And so really excited to have that team working with me. We have advocacy work going on at both the state and federal levels. So in a number of states, we actually have contracted lobbyists who work on behalf of March of Dimes and work with local partners to be able to advance legislation for moms and babies. And then at the federal level, we've got a team that works not only with members of Congress, but throughout the executive branch and with partners throughout the national scene, particularly in DC, to be able to advance this work.
That's so amazing. And I think one of the biggest part of everything you've discussed is that you're hitting the pulse of everything. You know, being a bedside provider myself, sometimes research, advocacy spotlight could be just a little bit off of what we are feeling as what's really the priority, but you haven't missed the beat at all. It is actually what's not only important, but relevant to those providing care and those that are seeking and getting the care across the nation. So we appreciate that so much. And your leadership has been so instrumental nationally. Is there any initiative or experience that stands out to you on the state or national level that you've seen in the past few years that you've been involved with that really kind of brings to light what this passion and involvement you've been doing over the years means?
Oh my goodness. I will tell you, so many times over the course of my career, I feel like the kid who sort of gets lucky and gets all the things he wants, and that I've had this opportunity to be a part of amazing work with tremendously brilliant and passionate colleagues across the country. And so if I think about my time in Tennessee, some things that come to mind. When I first arrived at the Department of Health, I was very interested in how we support breastfeeding moms. And I remember asking a colleague, what support do we offer when moms who are breastfeeding have questions? And they said, well, we have this warm line that's available from 9 to 4, Monday through Friday. And I said, that's great. But what about moms who have questions outside of that, you know, late at night or on the weekends? And So we put our heads together and we worked with clinicians across the state, including some folks who volunteered from TIPQC, and we came up with the idea of the Tennessee Breastfeeding Hotline. We had to get creative with funding. We actually blended funding from our WIC program and also our state maternal and child health block grant, and we stood up that breastfeeding hotline. It was one of the first of such hotlines in the country, providing 24/7 access to breastfeeding support. And when we first started the hotline, I thought we were going to get these really esoteric, complicated questions about breastfeeding. And what we found just a few months in were the reasons that moms were calling, but also providers and dads and other family members were calling, were really basic bread and butter questions about breastfeeding. And what really warmed my heart about that were that we could do something about those questions. We could answer those questions. And those very basic, easy questions should never be the stumbling block to a family meeting their breastfeeding goals. And so it was really exciting to be able to see that work take off. We also, during my time in Tennessee, partnered with folks across the state on how to tackle issues around substance use disorder and the impact on babies. So in particular, neonatal opioid withdrawal syndrome. At the time, what we talked about is neonatal abstinence syndrome. And I distinctly remember early in my time there getting a call from a neonatal intensive care unit in East Tennessee. And the director there said, "We are bursting at the seams with babies who are experiencing withdrawal. What are you all seeing across the state?" And we didn't have a great answer. We didn't have real-time data on the incidence of babies experiencing withdrawal. We had hospital discharge data, but those data couldn't be released until 18 months after a particular date of service. And so it really created the situation where we were sort of flying blind in terms of being able to make good state programmatic and policy decisions. And we realized we needed more real-time data. And so our team was tasked by the state health commissioner to stand up a surveillance system for neonatal abstinence syndrome. Again, at the time, that was the terminology we used. And we used the reportable disease platform. So clinicians are accustomed to reporting diseases that are highly contagious or very rare so that outbreak investigations can occur or appropriate tracking, contact tracing, those kinds of things can occur. So this was a little bit unusual to use this for a condition like opioid withdrawal, but we worked with partners across the state. And this was one of those times where I learned it's so important to get broad input. So while everybody could wrap their heads around the notion that we needed more information and more real-time information around opioid withdrawal, there was great concern about what we were going to do as a state health department with that data. Were we going to take a punitive approach? At the time, there was starting to be some legislative swirl, for example, that really was taking an approach of criminalization to women who were using substances during pregnancy. And so we had to navigate this space of how do we collect good data, but do that in a way that doesn't jeopardize mom or baby. And so we worked really closely with hospitals, with providers in those hospitals, nursing staff, physician staff, across the spectrum, OB, pediatric, MFM, neonatal, to really get a broad variety of perspectives, social workers. We also included some family members. We worked with folks at the Department of Children's Services, the State Child Welfare Agency, and came up with a way for hospitals to report in a de-identified manner that would give us information about how often they were admitting babies that were experiencing withdrawal. But we also collected some information on the exposure source. And when I think about that project, that's one of the things that I'm most proud about, is that we were able to change the narrative. I think early on when we started talking about this, particularly with some of the legislative approaches, there was this sense that these were women who were intentionally doing bad things to harm babies. And I remember hearing conversations that really sort of pushed the conversation in that direction. And what we were able to show from our data collection was that the majority of babies born with withdrawal were born to moms who were using at least one substance prescribed to them by a licensed prescriber in the state of Tennessee. And that really helped change the narrative from those quote-unquote bad moms who were doing quote-unquote bad things to this really systematic problem we had with pain management and with screening for substance use disorder, referral for treatment, actually having treatment available. And those data really allowed us to shift the conversation. And that wouldn't have been possible without strong collaboration across the state. And so those things jump out for me at the state level. At the federal level, I was really so fortunate to be there at a time when there was strong interest in maternal health. And that strong interest was not just from the administration, but also from the department, meaning Health and Human Services, the Congress, and also a variety of national stakeholder organizations. So I was fortunate to be there in a time when we were able to actually get new dollars and new legislative authorities for programs like the National Maternal Mental Health Hotline, which we were able to stand up and provide 24/7 call or text support for moms, pregnant women or new moms who had questions or concerns. We know that access to mental health resources are limited in many parts of the country. And so being able to pick up the phone or text and be able to get help from someone who has special expertise in perinatal psychiatry is really a wonderful resource. And our team was excited to be able to stand that up. We also expanded a number of maternal health investments to states. Having spent time in Tennessee, I knew how important it was for states to have the flexibility to be able to address their state-specific needs and concerns. And so we were really able to grow our maternal health innovation portfolio. Tennessee was one of the states that received those maternal health innovation awards to be able to put together a maternal health task force and use data from the maternal mortality review committees and other state data to be able to develop and then implement state-specific solutions to challenges. One of the important lessons I learned in Tennessee was what works in one state may not work in another. In fact, what works in Memphis may not work in Knoxville or Nashville. And so you really have to be able to tailor those solutions from state to state or community to community within a state. And those innovation awards allowed states to do that. We also were able to carve out some additional resources to support states to implement the Alliance for Innovation on Maternal Health, or AIM, patient safety bundles. And we know that organizations like TIPQC across the country have taken those AIM safety bundles and used that as an important part of the quality improvement work that you all do every day. Prior to a few years ago, there was not really state implementation money to support that. And so I was really excited to be able to help our team find ways to be able to do that and increase the support going to states.
Such pivotal work. I tell you, I can personally say I've seen the needle move in the right direction when it comes to the crisis as it relates to maternal health and infant health, not only in the state, but nationally. You mentioned the AIM bundles, which was my next question, and the national level work that you've done there with that effort. What role do you see perinatal quality collaboratives, or PQCs, playing in addressing the maternal and infant health crisis as it relates to those bundles?
Well, you use that word crisis, and I think it's so important to recognize we are in a time of crisis. So the United States is among the most dangerous high-income countries for giving birth. And I think when people hear that, sometimes they're in a state of disbelief. How could this be in the United States in 2025 or now 2026? But in fact, that is true. Every single day, we lose two women in this country, either during pregnancy or labor and delivery or the year postpartum. And every hour of every day, we lose two babies in this country before their first birthday. And so PQCs really play a vital role in helping us to address this crisis. The solution to this crisis can't be driven solely by the federal government or by state governments or by a single organization. And the progress that we are starting to see in parts of the country really happens as trust is built locally and change is able to happen. Sometimes that's clinic by clinic, hospital by hospital. But those changes from facility to facility start to add up. It's like a snowball rolling down a hill. You start to make some progress and suddenly you start to see that in a region, and then you see it at a state level, and then we start to see those wheels turn nationally as well. And I think PQCs have shown us time and time again that they really can be the engine behind that change, whether we're talking about improving readiness to be able to respond to obstetrical hemorrhage, whether we talk about reducing unnecessary inductions or C-sections. I think about the pivotal work around early elective deliveries and the campaign around 39 weeks. Now we know there's a big push around hypertensive disorders of pregnancy and thinking about interventions like low-dose aspirin. Folks aren't looking for talking heads out of the White House or HHS or even the State Health Department to tell them what to do there. They're looking for trusted advice from their providers and the places they seek care. And the Perinatal Quality Collaboratives and in Tennessee, TIPQC is right there at that interface and making that change happen. I think one of the exciting opportunities for PQCs moving forward is to continue to think about how the work that has historically been rooted in hospital settings is broadened out into the community. And I think that's particularly important in places like Tennessee, where we know we have many communities that are maternity care deserts, those counties where there's not an obstetric provider, so no OBGYN, no family physician who does deliveries, no midwife, but also no obstetric facility like a birthing hospital or a birthing center. Nationally, about a third of our counties are maternity care deserts, slightly more than that in Tennessee. And we know that for women who live in maternity care deserts, not only do they have to drive farther to care, but their outcomes are worse, whether we're talking about outcomes for moms and babies. And so it's going to be really vital that we think about how we engage partners in the PQC work, like community health centers, like community-based organizations where women may be seeking care or services, and where we may have some touch points to be able to address care before women show up for labor and delivery or to the hospital for an obstetric emergency.
You're right. The PQCs do feel like the connection point or the glue that brings it all together for the state. And I'm so glad you brought up the local build up to the national. Sometimes we feel it's a trickle down, but in this case, I completely agree that it's a build up so that everyone's on the same page in their own unique way. And we address the crisis, as you mentioned. For those that are hospital partners and our clinic partners listening today who may be interested in public health or policy, I tell you, the things you've shared, getting us all motivated to either start or continue the work that we're doing, but they may not know quite how to get connected into this type of work. What advice would you give as they're looking forward to joining in on the efforts?
Well, I often talk to clinical partners about thinking about the things that frustrate you in your practice. Is it related to your patients having difficulty with transportation services, for example? Is it coverage for a particular item from an insurance payer? Is it the way that your hospital or your health system approaches a particular clinical practice and approach to care? All of us can find those opportunities where we wish things were better. And so to that, I say, then start where you are. So if there's a challenge in the way, for example, your hospital approaches low-dose aspirin for reducing the risk of preeclampsia, maybe you work in an outpatient clinical setting and you haven't built in the standardized screening to assess a pregnant woman's risk for preeclampsia and understanding whether it makes sense to prescribe her low-dose aspirin. You could think about what would it take in this setting to be able to implement a protocol for that and to change our practice. And maybe you start in your own clinic with your panel of patients and then you grow from there. I think a lot of times people think, oh, well, I would have to go to Congress to get a bill changed. But fortunately, we don't have to do that in many cases. If we had to do that, things would move a lot more slowly. But the reality is we can make change where we are. And so think about where there are those opportunities for improvement. Think about where there are those areas, too, where you're really passionate about or where you've got a curiosity. I distinctly remember when I was a resident, actually an intern. So I started out in my internship in July in the NICU. So sort of thrown in feet first into the deep end and didn't know what the heck I was doing the first few days there. But by the end of that first month, was starting to feel a little bit more confident in what I was doing. And I remember we were rounding one day, Dr. Bill Walsh, who was one of my attendings at Vanderbilt and in neonatology. And I had rattled off the vent settings and what we were going to do for TPN and sort of felt that I had a polished presentation. And Dr. Walsh looked at me and he said, but Michael, why was this baby premature in the first place? And it sort of stuck with me. I was so focused on caring for the baby in the here and now that I hadn't taken the opportunity to think upstream about why did we have this clinical outcome in the first place? And so the next logical question is, what could we have done to have a better outcome? And Dr. Walsh was one of many clinicians I was exposed to who modeled that sense of inquiry for me, but also then taking that inquiry and sometimes frustration into systems level change and thinking about what could we do at the state level, for example, to address preterm births and where are there opportunities. And so I just encourage folks to get involved. It can be as small or as big as you would like it to be. Find that area that brings you joy and that gets you excited and take your expertise to the table. I think sometimes folks also worry that, oh my gosh, it's intimidating to go and talk to folks at the state health department or the legislature or the Congress. I promise you, you are far and away the expert in maternal health or infant health in the room. You eat, sleep, and breathe this every day. This is your practice. This is your life's work. And so you're going to know far more than the folks you're talking to, and they really are going to depend on you for your expertise and your guidance as they're thinking about programs or policies. So really take advantage of that and share your expertise and make a difference.
Absolutely. We all have something to offer. We just have to remember that we have to be vocal and join the cause if that's where our passions lead, just as you mentioned. But just for the last few minutes of our talk today, let's talk about the March of Dimes, and especially the national focus the March of Dimes has now on just keeping safe, again, moms and babies, particularly babies, as we move forward in this work. Of course, we want to know how we in Tennessee can continue to collaborate with the March of Dimes and to improve outcomes for our moms and babies. Can you share a little on that topic?
Absolutely. So at March of Dimes right now, we have three main focus areas. Those are preterm birth, access to care, and hypertensive disorders of pregnancy. We know preterm birth is important in Tennessee. Almost 11% of all babies are born premature. We know that when babies come earlier than anticipated, they're more likely to be very sick, more likely to be admitted to the intensive care unit, more likely to have complications, and in fact, more likely to not survive to see their first birthday. And so there's a real focus for us on continuing to understand why babies are born prematurely in the cases where we don't know, and to be able to deploy interventions that can reduce the risk of prematurity in the first place, but also to be able to support systems so that when babies are born premature, they get the best possible care in the right place so they've got the best possible chance of not only surviving, but thriving. So that preterm birth area is one area of focus for us. Another is access to care. We talked earlier about maternity care deserts, and over a third of counties in this country lack obstetric providers or obstetric facilities. And I think when people hear that term deserts, they think about naturally occurring deserts. And one of the things I always like to point out is, unlike those naturally occurring deserts where species have adapted over millennia to thrive in an environment of scarcity, the deserts we're talking about are the result of deliberate policy decisions and deliberate resource allocations, or in fact, under allocations. And so these are areas where outcomes are not good and where folks have not adapted and where we've got tremendous opportunity to be able to make sure that care is available in the communities where people live to be able to get outcomes that are better for moms and babies. And this is an area that really requires engagement with state and federal partners. So for example, thinking about state Medicaid policies around reimbursement and making sure that you can't just pay for services in a low volume facility. You've got to think about how you support that facility to be ready 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for whatever obstetric emergency might walk in the door. And in a low volume setting, like a rural hospital, the traditional payment models don't necessarily work. And so those policymakers have to think differently about that. But we've also got to think about workforce issues. So just having a facility is one piece of that puzzle. Having the folks to actually work in that facility is an entirely different question. And so continuing to work with folks at the state and federal level to think about how we address both payment and reimbursement issues, but also workforce issues. And then lastly, I mentioned this area of focus around hypertensive disorders of pregnancy. We know collectively those are an important cause of pregnancy-related morbidity and mortality. We've got really good data from state maternal mortality review committees like the one in Tennessee that have highlighted a tremendous opportunity for improvement here. And this is a place where we've got some interventions that are relatively straightforward, like low-dose aspirin, that are cost-effective, that are, as interventions go, incredibly cheap. And yet we know they are woefully underused. So for women who are at high risk for preeclampsia, less than half of them in a national study were receiving a recommendation or prescription for low-dose aspirin from their provider. And so this is a great opportunity to be able to engage in this and to think not only about, you know, what's our practice like in hospital, but in outpatient clinics, how do we pull in partners like retail pharmacies to be able to help us do this work? How do we think about messaging strategies in communities? So maybe partners from community-based organizations or trusted voices in communities. And I was so excited in preparing for the podcast to spend some time on the TIPQC website and to see you've now got over a dozen facilities that have signed up to participate in the SMFM Learning Collaborative on Hypertensive Disorders of Pregnancy. So not surprised at all to see that TIPQC continues to lead the way in this work, and really excited to see what you all learn and how we can scale that work nationally.
We're very excited about that and all the work that we do and how we've kind of put our stamp on things and the reputation we've built as being a resource for the state. And we appreciate partnerships with yourself and March of Dimes and the organizations that you champion as well and you lead. My final question, as I know I could talk to you all day and pull all of the great information out, but we do have to definitely get you back to the great work you're doing. We know that recently the March of Dimes released the annual report card, and that is very much so something that is the talk among not only providers, but patients as a great resource to understand current state. Can you tell us more about the most recent report card and, of course, any highlights for Tennessee that we would need to know?
Yes. So every year on World Prematurity Day, March of Dimes releases a national report card that gives the nation a grade for preterm birth. We also release state-level report cards on that same day that contain information on how a state is doing not only on preterm birth, but a number of maternal and infant health indicators. So this year in November of 2025, we released our report card and the nation got a D+ for prematurity. We are unfortunately stuck. This is the fourth year in a row where nationally we got a D+. And the preterm birth rate of over 10%. So more than 10% of all babies in this country born too early. And at the national level, we saw some particularly worrisome changes this year. We saw increases in a number of chronic diseases before pregnancy, and we know those increase the risk of suboptimal outcomes for both mom and baby. And we also saw challenges related to care, particularly women who are entering prenatal care later than the first trimester and women who aren't getting all of the recommended prenatal care. So that was the picture nationally. In Tennessee, Tennessee got a D for preterm birth. Almost 11% of all babies in Tennessee born prematurely, so worse than the national average. And high rates of chronic disease, whether we're talking about diabetes or high blood pressure or unhealthy weight before pregnancy, Tennessee's rates were higher than the national average on all of those. And I do think it's important to talk about bright spots. And so for any of us who have gotten report cards, none of us would be happy with this grade of D, but you also want to say, well, is there anywhere I'm improving or anywhere where I'm doing well? And we actually highlighted Tennessee as one of the states that had made statistically significant improvement in preterm birth rates year on year. And so while the rates are still too high and still higher than the national average, we really believe it's important to celebrate progress. And so I think, for example, about the work that's been done around pregnancy smoking in Tennessee and thinking about making sure that counseling is done during the course of prenatal care and other prenatal interactions, and those support services are provided to support cessation across the state. We're starting to see a difference being made there. And that's translating not only to decreases in pregnancy smoking, but also decreases in preterm birth. I think that these data also point out the tremendous opportunity that lies in front of us. So I know folks in Tennessee, they are competitive. They want to lead nationally. They're not satisfied with the D. They want to do better. And so this report card really outlines a number of opportunities for improvement. One of the things that's included in the report card is the proportion of births that are covered by a state's Medicaid program. So in Tennessee, Medicaid is 10 care, and you've got the managed care organizations. I know for many years, both 10 care and the managed care organizations have been strong partners with TIPQC in moving this work forward. And I think that's vital. Almost half of all babies born in Tennessee, those births are paid for by Medicaid. It's about 47%. And so if we're going to improve birth outcomes, we can't do that without 10 care and without the MCOs being a vital partner. And so it's really exciting and encouraging to see that historically they've been so engaged with the work of TIPQC. And I hope you all will continue that moving forward.
Well, thank you for sharing. I appreciate current state. I think we all appreciate knowing current state, because the one word I'm going to leave us with is it creates opportunity for advancement in all ways. And definitely, as we mentioned before, it's very motivating to keep doing what we're doing and to look for more progress areas that we can move towards or emphasize. Well, I appreciate all your time today, Dr. Warren, and we appreciate again so much. We're so grateful for the work that you do for moms and babies, not only in Tennessee, but across the state. We thank you for joining us today for our podcast, and we thank everyone for joining us. Please join us again, as we'll have more national leaders to discuss the great work we're doing for moms and babies, not only in the state of Tennessee, but the nation. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee, presented by TIPQC. TIPQC is funded under a grant contract with the state of Tennessee. Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee is brought to you through a cooperative agreement with the Alliance for Innovation on Maternal Health. Do you have ideas for a future guest or topic, or even have a question you would like answered on upcoming episodes? Visit www.tipqc.org. That's TIPQC.org, and click on podcast to submit suggestions and questions to our podcast team. Make sure to subscribe to our podcast to be the first to know when new episodes are available, and find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube to stay in the loop with our active projects and other relevant news relating to perinatal health in Tennessee.